Welcome to Capitalism Today, the program that examines both the advantages and disadvantages of the capitalist system, the economic system in which we live and work. I'm Chris Wanamaker, and today we'll hear from two important anti-poverty organizers. We'll hear from Donna Gates, the executive director of Living St. John, a group that is being given $10 million by government over a five-year period to combat poverty in St. John. That's later in the program. First, though, because St. John and Toronto have the highest child poverty rates in this country, I will talk to a longtime anti-poverty activist in Toronto. His name is Barry Weisletter, and he's director of Socialist Action, an anti-capitalist and pro-socialist group in Toronto. So, Barry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I've looked forward to it. I'm glad to be part of it.
So maybe we can begin by getting your observations about poverty in Toronto, since the St. John child poverty rate and the Toronto child poverty rate are so similar. They're the highest in the country. Can you describe the problem of poverty from your perspective in Toronto?
Well, it's rising. And, we have a situation where, one in three children in single parent families, one in five under the age of 18 live in poverty. One in two First Nations children lives in poverty. 40% of Indigenous children, which includes a good number who reside in the Greater Toronto area, are in poverty. More than one-third of food bank users across Canada were children in 2016. One in seven of those are using shelters in Canada are children. So poverty is really child poverty, as well as poverty affecting about 20% of the population, and it's more in Toronto and sadly in New Brunswick as well. And poverty is a function of class society in general, and of capitalism in particular. And if you like, I can elaborate on that. But there's a growing inequality, and there's a growing incidence of precarious employment, which means that people cannot make a decent living to put food on the table and keep a roof overhead, and that is outrageous in a country as rich as Canada.
So you say things are actually getting worse, not better, in Toronto. Can you elaborate on that and the connection between that and what you see as the systemic causes of poverty, especially in terms of capitalism?
Well, in terms of the specific direction, yes, things are certainly getting significantly worse. There's a rising incidence of impoverishment. There's a rising incidence of social and health consequences of increasing inequality and decreasing ability to pay for the necessities of life. This is reflected in housing. It's reflected in lack of access to transportation, and it's reflected in the diminishing number of decent full-time jobs. That produces growing insecurity. And why is this? Well, the short word for it, and people have heard this word before, is austerity. Capitalist austerity is particularly egregious, and by austerity I mean the agenda of the business class, which is to make working people pay for the recurring crises of the capitalist system. We had a stock market crash, a great recession, as your listeners will recall, in 2006, 7, 8. And Canada and the world has scarcely even begun to recover from that. In fact, we can say above and beyond the Great Recession that wages in Canada have been frozen for 35 years. They have lagged behind even the low rate of inflation. Efforts have been made to stifle the endeavor by working people to try to raise wages and to avoid layoffs and cuts to social services, which you become more and more dependent upon when you see your income decline to the point where you can't afford to purchase your needs on the so-called free market. This freeze in wages is in itself a reflection of diminished resistance by the organized working class movement, the trade union movement, to the austerity agenda. And as I mentioned before, austerity is an agenda designed by the capitalist class and reinforced by the capitalist state in service of that class, of profit recovery from the bursting of the bubble. So much of wealth, and I put wealth in quotation marks, is associated with speculation, investment in non-productive areas of the economy, and of course wealth leaks out of the economy and into foreign tax havens. It's estimated that as a result of tax avoidance, the public coffers have lost an estimated $15 billion a year. You can imagine what $15 billion could buy in terms of a national child care program, a national pharmacare program.
Barry, if I can ask, where do you get that particular figure from? That sounds like an important one.
Yeah, the Toronto Star published an investigation of tax havens. At first it was the Panama Papers, and more recently the Paradise Papers. And these were published, December the 13th, 14th, and 15th. It's all online. Anyone listening to this program can look at the results of the investigation that were published in the Toronto Star. The Toronto Star is not a socialist publication. It's the liberal wing of the capitalist austerity agenda. But the Star, wants to generate some readership interest, so they publish some stuff that's critical of the system, or at least critical of the policies of the government, which they support, the Justin Trudeau government. And the truth seeps out through the pores of these investigations and articles. And of course, there's an international consortium of journalists who investigated in dozens of countries simultaneously the tax havens and the money that's stashed away there beyond the reach of the tax man. For this, we pay a big price. This deepens the misery of those who are low wage, and it encourages conservatives in particular and right wing liberals to demand more taxes on those who can least afford to pay them, taxes on the so-called middle class, the employed working people of the country, and they become resentful because they know that they're paying more for less. And they know that many of them know, not all, but many who read these reports in the daily press know that there are billionaires who are paying hardly any taxes at all. In fact, there are corporations that despoil the environment, and they're actually paid by the government to continue to do so.
So Barry, a lot of this information is publicly available. The statistics that you're citing, actually, when put together the way that you have just put them together now, are actually outrageous. You use that word. Why aren't people more upset about what's going on?
Because they're unaware of the facts. They're unaware of the duplicity of the government and its laws with respect to the abusers. The abusers, who are, the 0.1% of the population, which commands, industry and commerce in this country. People are just not aware of it because they're fed a steady diet of cheerleading for, the government in particular, whether it's a provincial government, even a municipal government, but certainly the federal government, where, according to the media, style conquers substance. Justin Trudeau, his famous selfies, his posturing as a feminist and as a as an advocate of Indigenous people's rights and social justice in the world. It's a farce and a fraud, but that's what people get. They get a steady diet of this kind of biased coverage, and and of course my critics will say, yeah, but what about the investigations and the reportage to which I just referred? Yeah, but how much, you know, how much space in the print media, how much time in the electronic media does this kind of reporting occupy on a day-to-day basis, year in, year out, decade after decade, generation after generation? It's a very, very, very small percentage of the coverage, just enough that the corporate media can say, well, we did report on that. Why are you complaining? But the agenda that is advanced, that is promulgated in the school system from every bully pulpit and the general mass media is, you know, is a very different picture. A very, very different picture, and that's what people are inundated with. So how do people actually engage in a critical practice? Well, when they can take the abuse no more, and they begin to look for a different sort of political leadership, when they look for a working class response to these outrageous policies and practices of the less than 1%, they begin to turn towards the socialist movement. And I'm happy to say we are growing by leaps and bounds.
And Barry, when
in the last 2 or 3 years,
when you say we, you mean your group, Socialist Action? Can you?
I'm the federal secretary of Socialist Action, and we have members across this country, from St. John's, Newfoundland to St. John, New Brunswick, Montreal, Kingston, Toronto, Niagara Falls, London, all across Southern Ontario, Winnipeg, Edmonton, Vancouver, Victoria. We have supporters in the work that we do in the labor movement, in the workers' action movement, which is a class struggle left wing we're building in the unions and in several unions to replace the present conservative labor leadership, which has made concessions to the super rich and to the state, and discouraging workers from fighting back against the two-tier and against the poverty wages. And we work inside the labor-based NDP to fight for socialist policies. We work through the NDP Socialist Caucus, which is the united front of the organized left in that mass labor party. There is no labor party in the United States. We want to see the NDP go the direction that is demonstrated by Jeremy Corbyn in the British Labour Party, demanding renationalization of privatized sectors of the economy, taxation of the rich, a break with war policies, a break with the nuclear industry and the nuclear arsenal.
And can you tell us what you mean by the word nationalization? What does nationalization mean exactly?
It means bringing into public ownership a particular industry or a particular sector of the economy. So, for example, Margaret Thatcher privatized the British rail system, privatized the water system, the drinking water system in that country, privatized the post office. Jeremy Corbyn says these entities, these corporations, these services should be brought back into public ownership. And we add, they should be brought back into public ownership with minimal compensation to the owners, to the present owners, and they should be operated under workers' control. And that the chief executive officers in charge of rail or post office or water or Ontario Hydro, which was privatized in recent years in the province where I reside, Petro-Canada was privatized. We need to bring back into public ownership oil and gas industry in Canada.
When you talk about oil and gas, Barry, here in St. John, of course, as you probably know, Irving is big, huge, actually. The other three big corporations here are Olin, Ganong, and McCain, and actually you probably could include others as well. And call centers. Call centers are everywhere in New Brunswick and in St. John. I'm actually talking to you from the 107.3 FM studios on the campus of the University of New Brunswick here in St. John. And this is a campus with buildings named after some of the wealthiest entrepreneurs in the history of the province. For example, there's K.C. Irving Hall, there's Philip W. Oland Hall, there's William F. Ganong Hall, among others. So in your view, kind of bringing a St. John perspective into this, should these corporations be publicly owned, do you think?
Well, absolutely. I mean, any notion that there is a free market, that there is genuine competition, that these monopolies operate in the public interest and respond competitively to the demands of the public that fees are reduced to correspond to the ability of working people to pay for telecoms, for their telephone service or television cable service, or even for medical services that are not covered by cross-country Medicare, by the health insurance policies in each of the provinces, is just outrageous. And in a country as rich as ours, it's really impermissible. And we're calling out these giant corporations. We're calling out the McCain family. By the way, Bill Morneau, who's the country's liberal minister of finance, is married to a McCain, and he, has had to dodge some pretty persistent criticism for his manipulation of tax policy to benefit himself and the firm in which he was an owner to the tune of $1 billion when he moved to change the rules governing pensions. He has a piece of legislation, Bill C-27, which seeks to make defined pensions what he calls target pensions, and that is put the hard-earned pension reserves of working people into the stock market. And if they rise, fine. And if they fall flat because of a drop in the market, that's just the way it goes.
It sounds like you don't have a lot of faith in the stock market, but the stock market apparently has been doing quite well lately, especially in the U.S. What are your thoughts about that?
The stock market is a physical representation of the alienation of labor. All of the wealth in the world is the product of two things, labor and nature. Without working people at the helm, in every plant, in every mine, every mill, every research department, every hospital, every university, nothing would operate. And yet, while nature and labor make everything possible, the benefits of labor, the profit that flows from the production process, and by say production of services as well as goods, goes primarily to a tiny moneyed minority, and that's an injustice, which is the foundation for an exploitative capitalist society that exhibits growing inequality and growing impoverishment. If you want to change the system, you will not achieve that necessary fundamental change by means of charity or by means even of taxing corporations a little bit more. It's necessary to control the economy and to plan production to meet human needs, production for use rather than production for private profit. The corner grocery store is not what we're talking about nationalizing. We're talking about nationalizing the pulp and paper industry, the lumber industry, the mines and mills, the gas and oil energy sector, and converting by expropriating the profits from that sector, converting to green energy alternatives to break with the carbon dependency that is destroying the basis for civilization as a result of climate change.
Can you talk more, Barry, about what difference that would make for people in St. John? Would it have any effect on the poverty here or the poverty in Toronto, do you think?
And we could eliminate poverty in a decade.
Okay.
It's as simple as that. There's no need for homelessness. There's no need for food banks. There's no need for the misery of people who are living, you know, on the brink of disaster, one paycheck away from, total abject impoverishment. There's plenty of wealth and there's plenty of work that needs to be done. Technological change, robotization, automation has reduced the number of jobs. It has reduced the drudgery of work in many sectors of the economy. But who has derived the benefit of automation? Who has derived the benefit of growing productivity, of increasing productivity on a world scale? It's been the 0.1%. That productivity improvement, which is the result of the brain and brawn of the working class, every day applying its skills and its blood, sweat, and tears to production, should go to the majority, should go to the overwhelming majority. And if that were the case, there would be much more wealth available, not just, you know, the $15 billion every year that escapes the tax man because of, foreign tax havens, but, the profits from production in every major sector could be invested in education, could be invested in a crash program to produce housing so that no one would be homeless and everyone would have quality housing. In Toronto, you asked me specifically about the features of impoverishment here, where I live. The Toronto Housing Corporation, which is the largest public housing entity in the country, has a backlog of repairs that would cost $2 billion to address. And there's money for big business, and it's trophies and it's accomplishments writ large. But there's no money for housing. There's no money for safe, healthy food. There's no money for life-saving medical services. For drugs, many people who rely on drugs to dull the pain or to survive severe illnesses, cut the dosage in half, go without because it's a choice of food on the table or medication that's prescribed, and that's a bloody shame.
Yes, I agree. So assuming that this process toward public ownership could really get started, how would that happen, do you think? Or is it happening already in Canada?
Well, as socialists, we advocate that the labor movement and the NDP fight for these policies and seek to enact them in Parliament. But I really don't think that the ensemble of these changes that I advocate can be achieved solely through Parliament, or even mainly through Parliament. They will be achieved mainly through direct action in the workplace and in the streets. It's necessary to build a mass movement of working people coast to coast to coast with our allies internationally to demand the radical changes that I've advocated for the sake of the environment, for the sake of social justice, for the sake of the struggle against poverty, which is mainly the subject of this interview, and that movement must be relentless, and it requires a political leadership that will not compromise on the issue of the fight for a working class agenda. That means no alliance with capitalist parties, no concession to the boss's agenda, no tears for the capitalist crisis, and no way working people should be made to pay for a crisis that we did not create, a crisis that is inherent in an irrational and wasteful capitalist order. That's the kind of movement we strive to build. We strive to build it specifically by joining campaigns or initiating campaigns to raise the minimum wage, to put an end to precarious work. We supported, maybe your listeners heard about the strike by Ontario College Community College teachers.
Recently, wasn't it? Yes.
Yeah, it was just legislated back to work, strike-breaking legislation by a Liberal government, which ended that dispute without resolving it in favor of the just demands of the college teachers. And what were they asking? They were saying 70% of the teaching should not be done by, contract precarious part-time employees in the majority. Well, they were asking for 50% of the jobs to be, the teaching jobs to be full-time jobs. I would argue it should be much more than 50%. It should be the overwhelming majority should be full-time teaching jobs. And that's the way it was when the community college system began in Ontario in the late 1960s. Do you have a community college system in New Brunswick?
We have the New Brunswick Community College system here, yes, absolutely.
Well, I don't know the facts about it, but maybe your listeners do. How many of the teachers in that system are full-time? And how many don't know where they're going to be teaching a month from now or 2 months from now? They're just strung along and paid at the bottom rate, and they have to start at the bottom every time they come into a contract and begin teaching, and that means insecurity for them and for the students, and it really diminishes the quality of education. I don't want to dwell just on that particular struggle,
it sounds like you see a number of trends happening simultaneously. Whether and you could select any number of sectors or areas of society that are affected almost at the same time, and have been affected over the last 20-30 years by what the neoliberal agenda, the austerity agenda that you're talking about. Can you talk more about this agenda? You talked about the business class versus the working class, and it almost sounds a bit conspiratorial. Do you think it is that intentional, or do you think that it's just something that's just happened?
Well, it is a function of the system. I mean, conspiracy is a word that comes from two Latin words, which mean to breathe together.
So, oh, really?
Okay. The captains of industry, they belong to the same clubs. They sponsor the two main political parties. They hire people to do their thinking and planning, and they breathe. They do a lot of breathing together. But this is how the system operates. The primary goal of capitalism is to maximize profit, and the reason for the existence of the impoverished layer, the unemployed, the underemployed, is because it furnishes a reserve army of labor. It suppresses wages. It keeps the working class divided, and it props up the private profit system. So that's how it works. The maximization of profit. It's not that capitalist A whispers to capitalist B, who passes along a note to capitalist C, that this is what they ought to do as individuals. This is what we're all taught is as natural as the sun rising in the east and setting in the west. That's just the way things are. That's the way the system works. And without this system, we would be plunged into tyranny and barbarism. But that's absurd. The capitalist system is responsible for an endless series of wars and environmental disasters, which have been the result of millions of deaths and millions of displaced persons. The growing refugee crisis out of Africa and the Middle East, the southern countries fleeing into the north, is a result of the wars waged to pillage wealthy reserves of energy and mineral resources. And the only way to bring an end to this is to strike at the heart of the profit system, and that means transferring ownership from a tiny minority to those who actually do the work, who apply their brain and brawn to produce the things that are needed for human life.
So you would see
an end to the waste.
You would see workers both owning and controlling the enterprises in which they work then, or would you just see them as owning it and then other people being hired to manage it, perhaps?
The managers should come from the ranks of the working class, and they should be subject to immediate recall, and they should be paid a wage no more than the average top wage of workers who elect them to those jobs. If you hire people at millions of dollars to run Ontario Hydro or its equivalent in New Brunswick or anywhere else, you're going to get a mindset as well as a brain. And the mindset is elitist, and it's not about inclusion, and it's certainly not about democracy and responding to community needs and community desires. So democracy is not a luxury. And democracy is not something that happens exclusively in parliamentary elections once every 4 years. Economic democracy is the vision of the socialist movement, and we aim for it to be applied in the day-to-day life of every workplace and every community. Socialism without democracy is impossible.
So what is the state of the socialist movement in Toronto or even in Canada right at the moment? It doesn't seem like there's a huge number of people who would call themselves active socialists right at the moment, but maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe what is your experience?
Depends who you ask and how you ask.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask people, do you think Toronto should have clean drinking water and a functional sewer system? And waste collection and disposal. Do you think Toronto should have a firefighting service? Do you think Toronto should have a decent public transportation system and snow removal and all of the other things associated with public service? 99% would say yes. We absolutely need those things. And those things are the seeds of socialism. And people in their great majority defend those things. But our propaganda system, what governments and the media and figures of authority that are quoted in the media say every day, is at variance with that you know, economic, social, and political reality. So we have to bring it back to the reality, and working people need to make the connection.
So if somebody heard what you said and they perhaps were encouraged or inspired by your words and they wanted to do something, they wanted to get involved, what should they do?
Well, they should inform themselves and they should read and learn and engage in local organizing on issues that matter to them. I would say they should get in touch with my organization. That's one reason why I do interviews like this, not just to present a general theoretical conception of the nature of class society or to report on trends on the existing political, economic, and social landscape, but actually to inspire people to become politically engaged in revolutionary change. So I urge them to join Socialist Action. I urge them to go to our website, www.socialistaction.ca. I invite them to give us a call at 647-986-1917. That's 1917, the 100th anniversary of the first workers' state, the state that emerged from the Russian Revolution, before the devastating onset of Stalinism, which negated the brilliant gains of the Russian Revolution in 1917. I invite people to join, to read Socialist Action newspaper, which is published on a monthly basis. It's a North American newspaper with reportage particularly on Canada and the United States and world affairs and domestic issues. I invite people to join the Workers' Action Movement, which is something that we help to initiate to transform the unions from class collaborationists to class struggle bodies fighting for democratic workplaces and a workers' agenda. I invite people to join the NDP Socialist Caucus. NDPSocialist.ca is another website I strongly recommend people visit and get involved in the movement to push the NDP to the left and to lay the basis for a genuine socialist movement that can bring working people to power in this country.
I don't think you could have been more clearer in your articulation of the cause and of the need for it and of the need for social action and socialist action. So thank you very much, Barry, for joining us today.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you very much. You're listening to 107.3 Local FM in St. John, New Brunswick. I'm Chris Wanamaker, and this is Capitalism Today. A St. John group has begun testing and implementing new ways to end lifetime child poverty in this city, thanks to a funding agreement with the province. The executive director of the group is Donna Gates, and she's here with us today. So welcome to the program, Donna Gates.
Thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations on your group, Living SJ, receiving the $10 million to combat poverty over the next 5 years. That is amazing. How do you think you can make a difference?
Well, I think probably where I might start is just by giving an explanation of what Living SJ is. A lot of when I speak to people, they think that it's perhaps an organization, but Living SJ is actually a network. And so we're a network of business, of government, of nonprofit, and neighborhood leadership who are working together to end generational poverty in St. John. That's a really, really big ticket item. Obviously, we've got a very significant problem with not only poverty in St. John, but generational poverty. And so we, as a network, were thinking of ways how we could try to combat this. And we went to the provincial government and really with the idea that in poverty reduction, as with other complex social issues, there isn't really a space to innovate. And in particular, there's not really a space to have research and development. So we're looking at the Social Innovation Fund as a research and development opportunity. What I hear from a lot from my partners who work really on the front lines and also our neighborhood leaders is they've got great ideas. There's often just not a place that they would fit from a funding perspective. So we thought, what about if we had multi-year significant funding where we could test and innovate ideas? We could scale up things that are already working in St. John and really use our city as a living lab to test some policies that might need to be changed or systems that might need to be changed, and then present a case back to the provincial government at the end of the 5 years and say, this is what we learned, and we'd really like to talk to you about changing this or changing that. So the province was really a terrific partner in this and agreed, and we announced the fund earlier this year.
I think you're onto something, because my experience, as limited as it is with grant applications for funding, is that they tend to be like super structured and super rigid, and they're covering every I, making sure every I is dotted and every T is crossed. And so this is a very different approach, isn't it?
It is a very different approach, and you've hit on a couple of important things there. And I actually have a background in philanthropy too. So, you know, I'm used to filling those out. And oftentimes you have to find the new kind of shiny new program. And even if you're doing something that's really working, it's tough to get the funding for that. So again, if this is an idea that that our community has that is existing in St. John that can be scaled up, then would love to hear about that. And also new programming too. But I think it's very important. We have a lens that this is the community's funding and that decisions are being made about how the money is spent through the network. And we're engaging different people within the community, again, from those four groups I mentioned, government, business, nonprofit, and neighborhood leadership, at every point during this process. It's also interesting to note that there was really no blueprint for this anywhere in the country. This is really a first of its kind initiative. And again, the provincial government is certainly putting a lot of faith in our community, which is certainly, we've proven that we're organized in a way that warrants that, I believe. But you know, everything from how we would intake projects to who would review the projects has really been built from scratch by our community.
So who came up with the idea, just out of curiosity?
That's a great question. I don't know if I know exactly who, but I think it really came from conversations around, okay, we've got ideas, but there's no particular funding envelope that fits. Wouldn't it be great if we had sustained funding? Again, you know, a five-year commitment is a really amazing commitment, and multi-year funding as well. So one of the things we're looking at, if someone has an idea, but yet they need some time to cultivate that idea, much in the startup business world, is we would look at allocating smaller amounts of funding for that.
So how do you evaluate these ideas then?
Well, we've struck a committee. So again, from a community perspective, we looked at a skill set based on a number of different criteria, including people with lived experience, including, business person, a government person, again, to kind of really mirror that collective impact approach that we've used really since Living SJ's inception, which is now, we're probably in year four now. And so this group has come together and We actually had our first orientation meeting with them last week. So it's going to be my role to meet with people in the network that have ideas and to really get those to a place where the idea is solid. There's a team around the idea. The budget is really formalized. And again, this can be multi-year funding because it's difficult to study something significantly without doing it for a really significant length of time. And then the ideas would come to the committee, and the committee would review them, and then make recommendations based on funding.
Okay, So the committee decides then.
Yes, the committee is recommending the projects that go forward, and the Greater St. John Community Foundation is actually holding the fund for us as our community partner. So they'll make recommendations to them, and then the projects will be funded. It's also going to be important that we monitor the progress of the projects as they develop. This again really is about a learning experience. It's often difficult for government, if they start a new program, to cancel it or to change it. What we've said to government is we can be nimble, we can be agile, and if something isn't working, we can move quickly to change, to remove obstacles, to help guide the project along, or if it's really not working, then it will stop it.
So it sounds like ongoing evaluation of these projects is absolutely key to
Huge.
The whole approach, right? So whether or not it's working or not working is determined at every step of the way.
Absolutely.
Sounds like. And, yeah. And you're going to be monitoring everything fairly closely in order to ensure that the money is spent appropriately.
Yeah, I think you're raising a couple of really good points there, Chris. The first is a project wouldn't move forward unless it had a solid evaluation plan. So we're looking for a really transformational way to look at outcomes. So in a traditional funding model, you generally have your outcomes would be along the lines of how many people you served, how many students graduated, whatever, you know, kind of more of that transactional piece. What we're looking for are what are the outcomes? How do we actually, tying back to our Living SJ targets, so for example, our employment target is transitioning people off of social assistance into sustained living wage jobs. So how would we actually do that, and how would you measure that? And so each project has to have a very, very solid plan with milestones and outcomes attached to it, because at the end of the day, we're trying to illustrate social return on investment. So if we're able to, again, move people off of social assistance into employment, what cost savings does that have to government in the long run? A lot of this is documented, but we're trying to find new ways of measuring what that could be. The other thing that's one of our guiding principles, which is absolute measurement and evaluation at every turn. And really, this is what the province is demanding of us, is that if we're going to test this, and they've invested heavily in this, and we've said we're going to experiment and look but at what's working and what's not, but we have to be very diligent about what we measure.
So if you don't mind my asking, are you feeling any pressure around this?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think, you know, but I'm always guided by it's the right thing to do. And it's not just me, obviously. There's lots of people within our network who care so much about it. And people often ask me, well, how do I get involved with Living SJ? And I say, well, if you live in this community and you care about ending this problem and solving generational poverty, then you're part of Living SJ. So, and again, this is a real community approach. It's certainly, you know, I said to our committee when we met last week, even 6 months in, there's already things I would do differently. But there was no roadmap for this, so we're building it together, which is really, really exciting, actually. So when I do feel the pressure, I tend to just kind of think more about who we're helping and why is it important, and just really it's the right thing to do.
When I think about that pressure could come from different sources. Not that I want you to feel the pressure any more than you already are.
I'm hardest on myself, I think, generally. But anyway.
But there's pressure in terms of this being public funding that you
of
are
course,
responsible
yeah.
for spending. It's yeah. a large amount of of money, and it's going to be evaluated in different ways by different people at different times,
sure,
every step of the way. So that is a certain amount of pressure, but also reducing this intergenerational poverty that has been so persistent, mm-hmm, in St. John for so long that just it's so hard to make a dent in, it seems. Will you actually be able to do something to, you won't be able to eliminate poverty in St. John?
Well, I mean, ultimately, I think, yes. I mean, ultimately, that's the goal. It has to be the goal.
To end poverty in St. John.
Of course, because we all should be putting ourselves out of this work. That's the ultimate goal. I think that learning about what makes poverty so prevalent in St. John is a big step in that direction. And again, I think, you know, you're talking about a lot of interesting things there in that statement. You know, our community has decided that this is an issue they care deeply about. And I think where real transformational change happens is when it's not just the government's problem. It's not just the individual's problem. It's when a community says, it's ridiculous we have some of the highest child poverty rates in the country. It's absolutely absurd and appalling that we have such high poverty rates in our province of 750,000 people. When we look at our five neighborhoods of focus in St. John, which is the Old North End, Waterloo Village, Lower South End, the West Side, and Crescent Valley, you know, that's where our work is focused on, and we've got seven schools in those areas of focus. But I think it's our size that actually makes this doable. We're not Detroit. We're not Toronto. We are talking a population that we as a community can solve. We can make this a thing of the past, and we all have to believe that.
Okay. Do you have any ideas about, like, if I were to ask you how you think this would happen if it were the best case scenario, if it all worked the way that you dream it will work, just how would it go? How would you tell that you're really making a difference? Really making a difference, not just evaluating things that work and don't work and tweaking them here and tweaking them there, but how would you really make an impact?
That's a great question. Wow. I think, you know, what I often hear from my partners who are working on the front lines is in St. John, we have a culture of poverty, and that generational piece is really about children not seeing that, not having kind of role models or a mentoring in a way that they can see what their future looks like because their parents often didn't have it as well. So, you know, everybody wants the best for their children. Sometimes I think parents and families lack the tools. So I think success is really starts at the family unit and putting and having programs that not only look after the child, but look after the family as well. And so poverty is so complex, and this is why it is so difficult, is that everybody has unique reasons why they are living in poverty. And generally, things like mental health and addiction issues, domestic violence, those are somewhere in the mix. But everybody's story is different. And where we've seen great success in our community, and I'll give you the example of the St. John Learning Exchange, is that when you meet people where they are and provide wraparound supports to them, and that's not just, oh, we're going to help you find a job. That's, okay, here are the skills that are going to help you not only look for a job, but keep a job. So it's problem solving, it's team building, it's things like that. But also, what's going on in your family life? What are the other obstacles and barriers that you have in your life? And how can we actually provide real individual supports to people? So one of the things that the executive director of the St. John Learning Exchange told me recently that was a real aha moment for her, and I hope I'm getting back to answering your question, is that she has now graduates of her program who are calling her saying, I'd really like to look for another job. I'm happy-ish where I am, but I see more for myself, but I'm not going to quit the job I have. And so when you have a fundamental mind shift in you know, like that as an individual to say, I know the best place I'm starting from to look for that next thing in my life is where I am right now and to have the job instead of going, you know what, I'll just quit my job and go back on social assistance. When you make that transition, that's where you see real transformational change. And that only comes from working one-on-one with people.
Okay, so I hear you talking about one-on-one work with people and talking about this wraparound kind of approach. And part of what you say, I'm thinking of career development. You're kind of helping people focus on their careers, not just their jobs. Would that be a fair way to put it?
Yeah, we look at the aspect really from cradle to career. So a lot of our work actually on the education side, where our target is to close the education achievement gap that's often faced by students who are living in our five focus neighborhoods, is everything from, you know, that 0 to 5 early learning piece to enriched education after school, to high school completion rates. So there's so many examples I could give you of that. But one of the most powerful and one of my kind of personal favorites is actually something that happens here at UNB, is the Promise Partnership. So this is a mentoring program that links university students here with students in our priority schools. And one of the things that I've heard, which I just absolutely, you know, is kind of another aha moment for me, is that before this Promise Partnership program began, there were students living in Crescent Valley, for example, which is really just a stone's throw away from here, that didn't know there was a university in St. John. So really, that's powerful, because we have to start having conversations at a young age with the students to say, you know, these are the opportunities that are available to you, that post-secondary education can be part of your life plan. And we have now a free tuition program in New Brunswick, you know, where if your family income is less than a certain amount, you can apply for free tuition. That's obviously something that will be quite powerful in the lives of a lot of these families. But it really is about presenting opportunities. That's mentoring, that's enriched education, that's what quality after school care can look like. There's so many things wrapped up in that, but it really is about what we can be doing as a community to provide as many opportunities as possible to put equity back in those students' lives.
So it sounds like you're trying to help people work within the current economic system and make the best of their progress, their own personal and professional development within the economic system in which we live.
Sure. And I think again, it's about families wanting the best for their children. So, you know, one of the programs that we have in our network is a goal setting program where families can meet with someone and really look at how different aspects of their lives they can be setting goals. You know, that's financial, that's personal, that's work related. You know, is it opening a savings account? Is it those kinds of things? So again, I keep going back to this, but that's really that individualized approach to really working one-on-one with people to say, what is it that you need? What are the barriers that face you? I mean, oftentimes childcare affordability is a huge one. Transportation is a huge one. You know, the vast majority of people that live in our focus neighborhoods would not have a car. They would not be able to afford daycare or childcare, and those are the kinds of barriers, especially for lone parent families, which far and away are led by women. That's where our work really focuses on, is that family unit there, because that's how you break the cycle of generational poverty.
Okay, so people, you're trying to help people navigate this kind of complex system in which we live, right?
Yes.
And trying to help them set goals and trying to help them develop in so many different ways. And it sounds like you're looking at different things that can benefit from funding to help people meet these goals. What about the broader system in which we live? How much of the problem is an individual one versus one that is connected with the economic system in which we live, would you say?
Well, I think there's a lot there. I mean, certainly we have high rates of individuals on social assistance in St. John. So, you know, again, our work is really focused on providing getting the education opportunities there that help not only adults but children and families as well. I think it, you know, that is a tough one. I mean, with generational poverty, what I hear anecdotally is, again, it's not living in a family where someone is going to work every day. It's tough because, you know, I think there's a great argument to say that, you know, we need more jobs in St. John and we need to be doing things like that. I'm encouraged, again, by the free tuition program, the fact that trades are going to be brought back into schools. I think all those are great pieces, but our government has to be a partner in this. As I've said from the outset, I think when we start going, you know, this isn't here, or this doesn't work, or what's the government going to do to solve that problem, government can't do this alone. And that's a real, again, principle of Living SJ in our network, is that someone from government sits at every single one of our tables. We have amazing relationships with the Department of Social Development, for example. There are people who work in government who know where the problems are with the system, and they want just as desperately to see it changed as the people who they're working with. And so our philosophy really is, okay, we can only solve this together. This is collective impact with all four of these groups together. And I think economic conditions can always be better. I think the days of blaming the individual and blaming the government have to be over.
Okay.
That's my personal opinion.
Okay, thank you very much. One final question, Donna. In the best case scenario, realistically though speaking, how much do you hope to actually reduce poverty in 5 years?
The goal of our organization, it really is to end generational poverty. So, you know, I would say that 5 years is probably not enough time. I mean, generational poverty takes years to root, and it will take years to solve. I think that our next 5 years, as we look back on them, will be a real turning point, because we've really decided to look at this differently as a community, and our social innovation fund will be testing new models and scaling up things that work in a way that we can share what we've learned with all of New Brunswick and really the Maritimes in Canada and beyond. I think what's important to focus on, again, is that our community has decided this is an issue that we want to solve together, and that we are working towards that goal.
Donna, thank you for coming. Donna Gates, Executive Director of Living SJ, a new innovative project here in St. John. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Capitalism Today. I'm Chris Wanamaker. Thanks for joining us. I hope you've enjoyed these interviews. Stay tuned to 107.3 FM, local FM in St. John, New Brunswick, for more great programming.